This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Stay tuned. And this is Mike Fader. The show is Occupied Territory. We're here every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. And, of course, you can visit our Facebook page where we carry on these discussions offline, or off-air, I should say, online. So Facebook page is Occupied Territory and Facebook. Just Google that and you'll get there. And I post new articles all the time. We have debates. We have discussions, a lot of which repeat what goes on here on the air, and then it carries it further. So last week, we discussed the fiscal cliff, or whatever it really is. But I thought what we'd do is have somebody on here who has more experience in what these things actually mean and maybe can explain to us what really are the details of the deal that was reached in Washington. How permanent is it? Who does it affect? Who does it affect more than other people? Who wins? Who loses? And what the next argument or bargain has to be and how that'll affect people. So we have my friend Les Leopold with us. Hi, Les.
How you doing, Mike?
All right. Let me introduce you to people here.
Les, I got a new book for you to pin.
Oh, good. All right. So let me go through the stuff here, and then you can tell me about the new book. All right. Les Leopold is the executive director of the Labor Institute and Public Health Institute in New York. He has a previous book called The Looting of America, How Wall Street's Game of Fantasy Finance Destroyed Our Jobs, Pensions, and Prosperity, and What We Can Do About It. And he co-founded and currently directs two nonprofit educational organizations, as I mentioned, the Labor Institute and the Public Health Institute. He designs research and educational programs on occupational safety and health, the environment, and economics. And the new book is
How to Make $1 Million an Hour, Why Hedge Funds Get Away with Siphoning Off America's Wealth.
Okay.
It's available now, I think, on Kindle.
Mm-hmm.
The actual publication date is sometime later this month.
Okay. And so this is really basically, is it a history of hedge funds or how they work or both? Or?
No, it's a 12-step guide to making $1 million an hour. This is your big chance, Mike. You can buy the whole station when you're done reading the book.
I'm not interested in material things anymore, Les. This is for other people now. I've advanced to a different state of existence. But I thought
Well, you can give it away.
It's like steal this book? Okay.
That would have been nice if someone else thought of this title.
All right. So we have a deal that the millionaires made down in Washington with the help of lots of lobbying groups. And what I wanted to go over is how it affects us. Now, obviously, this was all on taxes. The spending side of all of this, negotiations, is yet to come. And, of course, then we'll have to deal with the debt ceiling. And all of this is mixed in together. But this deal was on taxes. And obviously, it seems to me from reading all the articles that I've read and from getting explanations, in at least online from other people, that this deal basically didn't put much of a dent in people who were very rich or rich at all. But definitely didn't. And it actually did help out, or at least it didn't hurt people who were very poor. Looks like the middle class are the ones who either got so left in neutral or got hurt by it. But maybe you could explain a little bit about it.
Well, one part of the deal was the payroll tax went up 2% again. It had been cut from 6.2 to 4.2. Now it's back up to 6.2. And that's going to hit working people from lower income through middle income the hardest. So that's the first thing. That's a tax increase for all of us.
That's
all the way up to about $110,000.
Now, there's a couple of questions on that, because, in fact, that's one of the ones that affects me, I mean, and you, I'm sure, and everybody who's listening, who's straight ahead, who makes, somewhere between 50 and 110 or 113,000, whatever the... So that affects us.
113, right.
Like, for instance, what it does is it wipes out any kind of, like, for instance, if the income tax did not go up for somebody in my bracket, it gets completely canceled out by the payroll tax going up. Let's say you make $60,000 or $70,000, and the average in America is, what, like $50,000 for a family, roughly, maybe less?
Roughly.
So, I mean, imagine a 2%, you know, tax on that's a lot of money in an environment where everything is going up, all costs keep going up. So that's a tremendous amount of, that's a real shot that the middle class takes. Is there anything the middle class people would be glad about as far as this goes?
Well, let's see. I did a little research to find to explain some of the details of what else got plugged into this bill. If you work in the TV or movie production industry, you will still have a big tax break that was designed to keep movies from moving to other countries. It was basically blackmail. And you can, if you work in that industry, you can shield $15-20 million of production costs from the first $20 million from taxes.
Well, not that's for the people who are owners, the people who make a lot of money, right?
Well, so. You know, if you were a lackey in that industry, you might have a temporary job. If you work at a NASCAR race track, there was a tax benefit that they were able to snare as well.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you worked in the Puerto Rican rum industry, there was a little tax giveaway that was held on. And also the retail restaurant improvement tax exemption was kept.
Which is?
You know, it's a little, if you own a restaurant, you can shelter some income if you, some extra income if you... a little faster, you can.
Well, there must be a couple.
Stuff.
There must be a couple of hundred industries and places like that. I guess these people were just more successful at lobbying or getting into the bill than other.
Yeah,
people.
They're really good at it. And of course, there was a, you know, the Medicare loophole. There was a, you know, another thing actually that might benefit the middle class is they put an inflation index to the alternative minimum tax computation. I don't think it hits us, but it might if you had a year where you had a lot of deductions, and now that it's not going to hit middle-income earners as much. But the big one, the biggest reason that the super-rich are going to stay super-rich is there's a little-understood loophole called the carried interest tax loophole, which basically means that the income... that those who run hedge funds and private equity firms, like Governor Romney did, they don't have their income taxed at the new rate of 39-point-whatever percent. Their tax will be only 20%.
No, it was 15 before that, right?
What's the scheme?
What, wasn't it 15% before that?
Oh, it was 15. It was like capital gains and dividends. So yes, that went up to 20%.
Mm-hmm.
But it should have gone up to for these people. It should have gone up to 39.6% because it's income. There is no other way to look at it. In other words, when these guys take your money and work night and day to find ways to increase it. And then take their share of that. Their share should be income. If they worked in a for a investment bank, that would be considered income, and it would be taxed like ordinary income. But because they work in these hedge funds and private equity concerns, they have a way of ducking it. Now, you're talking about the super, super, super rich people, like the guys that make, you know, $1 million an hour. These guys are still going to have the bulk of their income taxed at 20% and not at the ordinary rate. So my guess is when all said and done, the wealth and income distribution in the United States did not get any better as a result of this tax deal. I don't think it got a whole lot worse because some high earners, you know, 400,000 on up, are going to pay more, but it didn't get a whole lot better.
Nope.
And it'll never get better if we keep letting the Wall Street shysters off the hook.
Now, the fact that it didn't get worse is really worse in a way. If you look at the larger picture, in other words, the income inequality causes everything else to go wrong. So, for instance, if it didn't get worse, it just means that we're on a downward track. For most people in this country, actually, you know, statistically, most people, most voters, most citizens, most bodies in this country, and
In about a year, we know. Yeah. God willing, we're both still up and at it.
Yeah.
We can come back to this one and actually have the data that shows what it did to the income and wealth distribution. We got to remember wealth as well, because a lot of these wealthy people don't really get income. They let the money kind of accrue, and then mm-hmm. they borrow against it, and it never looks like it's income.
Mm-hmm.
So the wealthier you are, the less likely you are to pay an income tax.
But the hedge fund,
you're certainly not worrying about payroll deductions, because you don't get your money that way.
Well, the hedge fund people also, they get a lot of their money by charging huge fees for the management of the hedge fund. I mean, that's income per year, isn't it?
Well, part is and part isn't. The little part is, the big part isn't. Let's say they charge 2% and 20%, 2% up front for taking your money, and 20% of any profit they make
mm-hmm.
for you. So the 2% is treated as income, but they don't really take that. They use that to pay their staff and office expenses and things like that. It's the 20 that they take, and they make sure that 20 qualifies for the loophole.
I see.
That's what they're trying to do. They're trying to make sure that 20% qualifies for the loophole. So when they take it, they're paying 20%. And you are going to pay more than that.
So
whatever income you have, you're going to pay more than that, because your income is coming from payroll.
Right.
But their income is coming this way, and they've been able to. The outrageous thing is that they claim that this is like good for us. This is like really good for us.
Well, is that part of it?
They should be making $1 million an hour and paying a lower tax rate than the rest of us.
And that's good for us because of trickle down? I mean,
you
they're,
know what?
They're job
I,
creators.
I can't even understand the argument anymore. Innovation. Think of every single bland, vacuous, concept you can.
Mm-hmm.
Patriotism, motherhood, innovation, trickle down, whatever it is, they throw it at you while they put the money in their pocket. They're part of the casino. It's not productive. A lot of what they do, not only is it not productive, it's actually a drain on our economy, and it was part of what produced the crash the last time around. So this is absolutely outrageous. And the thing is, neither the Democrats nor the Republicans have the guts to go after that industry. They just don't want to mess with it because too much money comes their way in terms of campaign contributions.
Mm-hmm.
Obama at one point wanted to go after it, and his aide just said, no, wait, I'll touch it.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't buckle up. But there's a bigger issue here, Mike, that we've got to deal with. The bigger issue is what this is connected to. You mentioned we didn't even get to the spending issues. The first thing I think listeners need to understand is virtually everything you've heard about debt is wrong. We've been subject to the big lie. This guy Pete Peterson, by the way, one of the made his money in the private equity markets and took full advantage of at that point the 15% loophole. This guy has been on a crusade for years to convince the country that we're going to go broke, and it's just not true. And he's especially, they're not talking about closing the loopholes on the rich or having the rich pay more of the fair share or anything like that, or cutting the defense budget, God forbid.
Mm-hmm.
No, they're going after so-called entitlements. They're saying that Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security are not sustainable. And they're propagating an enormous fabrication, and we're falling for it. We're thinking, oh my God, we're running a deficit, and if we don't do something about it, we're going to end up like Greece. Just not true. I've been writing about this now for the past year, and every one of their claims is malarkey. If you look at it at all, it's just not true. So having a discussion about what to cut in terms of entitlements, or how to cut entitlements,
mm-hmm.
means we lose before we even start. It's just a way to eviscerate, the Great Society, New Deal programs that help low and middle income people. Their goal is to eviscerate that and protect their, what they consider their fair share of the economy, which is they want more and more of it. We already have the most unequal distribution of wealth in the history of America, and they want more of it. Now,
well, yeah, I mean,
let me get some basic
Yeah. I just wanted to add the basic debt stuff
that we got to understand.
Okay, let me just add first before we
go ahead, one
of the reasons why this happens, if people wonder why it happens, is I think probably most people listening to this show or who know you or know me don't fall for this stuff. But most people, all they hear is what they see on TV or what they read in the papers. And you've got a place like this Fix the Debt campaign. You know, these people that fix the debt.
Oh.
And they are the slimiest bastards of all because these are people who
are the lobbyists for the financial industry.
And they're on corporate boards at the same time. Yeah.
They're lobbyists for the largest corporations in America to make sure they get their tax breaks.
Right.
And then, meanwhile, they say, well, to pay for those tax breaks, right, that's called a tax expenditure, pay for those tax expenditures, we're going to take money away from, 70-year-old senior citizens. We're going to cut their inflation raises in their Social Security payments. Or we're going to make it older before you can get into Medicare. When we should be doing exactly the opposite.
But it's the same old problem with these people. They have the money to buy the ad space and to put this stuff on TV and to have full-page ads in newspapers. The people like us don't have that money, so people are submitted to this barrage of crap. How you tell people how you break through this wall of money and media and advertisement, I don't know.
We just got to keep banging away at it. There's one ad that one of the Peterson Front Group runs. I don't know if you've seen it with the a Chinese guy lecturing to Chinese students in China somewhere, and it's got subtitles, and he's explaining how America, this is like takes place in 2030, how America, fell apart because it, thought it could stimulate its way out of its problems and ran up its debt, and now we own their debt and they work for us. What percent of America debt does China own? Take a guess.
I have no idea.
From this, from the ad, you would think it would be 80-90%. 8%. 8%.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the debt is owned by Social Security and the Federal Reserve. We own most of our debt.
Social Security owns the debt?
Yeah. I mean, that's where they park some of the money. They buy some of the federal bonds.
Mm-hmm.
The world, it's a joke that grown men can put these lies out and not have them contested. And it does, you're right, it comes back through the media.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a piece in 2011, where the best people on NPR were parroting the line. They were asking their guests, "Geez, well, what do we have to cut? Tell us what we should be cutting."
Well, NPR.
And the answer is, don't cut anything
NPR.
Unless you want to cut military spending.
NPR takes NPR takes underwriting grants every 32 seconds from some huge coration. You mean NPR?
They don't even know the two are connection. They actually buy this kind of zeitgeist, which is that we're over our heads. Here's how the debt problem solves itself. If we were actually growing the economy, if we were moving money from Wall Street into Main Street and into, everyday people's pockets, the economy would, people would be put back to work. The economy would be growing, and then debt as a percent of the economy, lo and behold, it goes down. As a matter of fact, it's gone down. The deficit, the yearly deficit, has gone down each of the last 3 years. It's going to keep going down. That's what happens. Debt doesn't matter if your economy is growing. But if you cut back expenditures, especially for middle class and lower income people, your economy slows down, may even go into another recession. Then your debt looks like a bigger problem. Even if that happened, we are so far away from a debt crisis that the chances of us turning into Greece is the same chance of you finding a Martian in your bathtub. Now, at your house, maybe that's possible.
Yeah. We'd probably better use a better example. But I understand what you're saying. I mean, this is very much, it reminds me of what Homeland Security did. In other words, and the government. It's going to scare you to death every second. The terrorists are everywhere. They're going to blow everything up. So then they can pump billions of dollars into these programs, right? It's the same thing with this. We're going to all go expire from debt, so we better cut everything, right?
Well, also, people... Debt is, everybody knows on a personal level.
Sure.
Debt's not a great thing, right? So if you're, it always seems like, geez, I shouldn't run up too much debt. That's not a good thing. People get in trouble when they run up too much debt. So
I better cut my expenses, are you saying?
Yeah. Right.
Right.
But with the government, it's a completely different ballgame because debt only matters in relationship to your income. and what and the interest rates you're paying on the debt will determine what your income, what you can carry, right? If you've got a home, you're carrying a mortgage. If you have a decent income compared to your mortgage, no problem. Same thing, that's the same thing with a country. And our interest rates are almost zero. People are throwing money from all over the world. They want to buy our government debt because it's safest. It's the safest country in the world. And the only way it won't stay safe is if we artificially throw ourselves into another recession. And the way to do that is to go into an austerity program. Now, if you want to do, there are some long-term problems, and it's not Social Security. That's easily solved. That's, I mean, first of all, it doesn't go quote-unquote bankrupt, meaning that it would have to borrow money to make its yearly payments until it's been running up surpluses for generations, until 2033. I hope I'm around to see 2033. But all you have to do is raise that top level from 113 to let's say, $400,000 a year, and you'll have
the amount of money.
Yeah, the top. Right now, you stop paying. It's a regressive tax. The more you make, the less you pay as a percent of your income. So you start paying less and less as a percent. You start. You pay 6.2% up to $113,000, I believe it is, and then you pay zero. So you raise the
On anything over that.
Yeah. So yeah. you just raise it. Raise it any amount you want. $20,000. Raise it $100,000 more, and you've got money. Hand over fist. There's no Social Security problem.
What is? Well, since you don't have that, then maybe there is going to be a problem
in 2033.
But that's not so not far like away for a lot of people.
What?
Well, I mean, what? I'm serious. What happens? Let's say you're 50 years
23
old.
23 years.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Let's say you're 40. You're 40s and you're 50 years old. You know what I mean? Really? I mean,
it doesn't mean the money's. It just means that they have to borrow. It doesn't mean that there's no money in the trust fund. It just means the trust fund doesn't have enough to pay all projected to not pay, would have to borrow money.
There was an op-ed piece in the Times just this past Sunday by a statistician and somebody who pays attention to these things up at Harvard. I forget his name now. And he's going to come on my show in a couple of weeks.
Great.
And he analyzed all this. And he said, first of all, one thing he threw off was there was a $49 million deficit for the first time since 1983 in the Social Security income and outgo this year. A $49 million deficit. Now, there's probably lots of reasons for it. I guess the government has been borrowing for other, right? The government's been borrowing. I always thought that was illegal. Isn't that a separate protected trust fund? How can they borrow money from the
Not really. It's supposed to be, but they can move money back and forth. Mm. And by the way, $49 million.
Not a $49 billion. Yeah, $49 billion.
Yeah.
$49 billion.
Yeah, they can move it back and forth. But the program we have to look at, it's not Medicare or Medicaid. We have to look at our health care system. Our health care system is an absolute mess. Even after Obamacare, the fact is we're still relying on for-profit private companies to deliver, insurance companies and private hospital chains to deliver health care.
And their goal is to rip us off. Yeah, drug
so
companies.
So we spend a higher percentage of our national income, GDP, we spend, I just did a chart yesterday for a piece, for book proposal, another one I'm working on, and of the top 20 developed countries in the world, we spend 16% of our national income on healthcare. The next highest country is 12%. And of those 20 countries, we have the lowest life expectancy.
Yeah, there was an article.
We have the worst outcome.
Right.
We spend the most money per person, any way you want to look at it, we have the worst outcome.
Well, obviously,
that's because
obviously,
we're the only country that relies virtually entirely on the so-called private sector to deliver health care. It's a joke. You know what they're doing. They're just running up the cost as fast as they can. And then, of course, we have all these laws that say, oh, you can't bargain. Medicare can't bargain with the pharmaceutical industry to bring down the costs of drugs. So you have these outrageous sums of money and we have all kinds of procedures that, you know, we have a mess. And that's driving up the cost of Medicare and Medicaid, not Medicare and Medicaid itself. It's the underlying system that has to change. That's what we should be addressing. There are two things, three things we should be addressing if we want to have a sane conversation. Somebody, my Martian came down to Earth. Mm-hmm. They'd say, why aren't you talking about these three things? The incredible waste in the defense budget. You don't need all that armament in the modern world. You know, you can blow up the whole world 15 times over, and there's no other challenger. Why do we have all that?
Mm-hmm.
Two, Wall Street's way too large, and it has all this money, and it's just forming these casinos. We should get it out of there through a financial transaction tax. And three, we should go to single-payer health care and eliminate the insurance industry entirely, the healthcare insurance industry. Just wipe it out. One card in your pocket, you go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And if you make, you know, maybe you pay a small copay to keep you honest or something. But
and the transaction tax would be, give me the details. How would that work?
Simple. They already have one in the stock market in England, mm-hmm. which they've had it for 300 years. It's a small tax every time you buy or sell a bond. So if you're a high-speed trader flipping things over, you know, making a million transactions a second,
mm-hmm.
Then you're going to pay for it. You're going to pay a little fraction, but it's going to add up. So right now they estimate that 50 to 80% of the stock market transactions, 50 to 80% are high-speed traders who hold, for them a long-term hold is 2 seconds. So they're just flipping. They would be having to pay up. The profits that they make somewhere between $3 and $20 billion a year from this, which is like basically they're extracting the financial transaction tax.
Mm-hmm.
That's the joke of it. Right now, when you buy and sell something, if God forbid you should do such a thing,
mm-hmm.
But some of your listeners do,
mm-hmm.
For their IRAs or whatever, they're not getting the true price. They're getting the price. Their price has been bumped up by these high-frequency traders. They see you coming. They buy it before you buy it because they have these super-fast computers, and then they sell it back to you all in the blink of an eyelash.
Mm-hmm.
Boom. That's it. They bought it, sold it back to you, and you paid a couple pennies more. And they extract it. They're taking the financial transaction tax. So if you put a real financial transaction tax in, and you do it on stocks, bonds, derivatives, all these credit default swaps, the whole bunch of them, you would bring in a really nice revenue, and almost all of it, I'd say 99.9%, come from very, very wealthy people. That's what we need to do.
Well, that's clear enough.
Three things.
That's clear
Single
enough.
Payer, financial transaction, and slash and burn at the Defense Department.
Now, but then you have two political parties that you could vote for either one if you want any chance of anybody being in office that theoretically would represent you, and neither one of these parties would have anything to do with any of this, right?
Right.
I guess it is a problem. Are we going to sit here and watch our entire economy and our lives go right over, to mention a certain word, a cliff, and not be able to do anything about it? You know.
Well, Occupy Wall Street showed us the way. Unfortunately, they didn't have the tools or the experience to take the next step.
Mm.
But we need a movement that goes after the beast and that can mobilize outside the political party process for a while and, cause hell, basically engage in, it's shocking to me that we can have this many people unemployed for this long and not have mass demonstrations about that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you need to go first to the demonstration mode, and then there's a question of how to engage in political action once you know what you want and you've got an outraged public behind you. Third parties are tough formations in America, but you never know. They've happened. But articulating an alternative agenda, but as you said, piercing through this veil of fabrications that surround us,
mm-hmm.
requires somebody to call the question. Look, a bunch of basically kids raise the 1%, 99% theme. And put the finger on Wall Street, and you know what? It worked for a while.
It worked long enough to get in a man in office who is really basically working for them as well, as far as I can tell. I mean, it's too bad, you know. I mean,
no, he
ran against Romney, and he kept throwing in all this income inequality stuff. What a joke, even though Romney, you know, is making his speeches about the 47%. He didn't even have to do that because you had Obama and the Democrats seized hold of this 1%, 99% thing and said, you know, we're gonna have to raise taxes on the rich, and there is too much income inequality. It's a terrible thing. Meanwhile, you got a guy like Obama appoints Simpson Bowles. What's his name? Simpson, or is it Bowles?
Oh, yeah,
I can't.
Yeah.
One of them is in fix the debt.
He's
like, yeah, Bowles. I mean, is there any difference between Obama and Romney when it comes to these kinds of things like budget cuts and taxes?
I think there is a difference, but we're not putting on a lot of pressure. See, when Occupy Wall Street was going on, notice that the political discourse all of a sudden switched from deficits and debt reduction and entitlements to inequality in Wall Street,
mm-hmm.
where the conversation should have been in the first place. So Occupy Wall Street made a difference. The problem was it never found, because it didn't believe in organization, it didn't hook up with larger groups because it was afraid to would lose its identity and its hand signals.
Yeah,
or
I had
whatever,
plenty of experience with them on the show. I'd invite people.
Didn't hook up with the labor movement.
It never worked. It didn't hook up with anybody else. And this lack of organization was maddening for people even who were trying to help, because I would get in touch with all these different places, whatever city it was, and they would put it to a vote in some committee somewhere, and I never heard a word back from them. You know,
it's funny. There are a lot of critiques you can make about what was going on in the 1960s, but I got to say, those kids were damn good organizers. You want to have a mass demonstration in Washington? They figured out how to do it. They were able to hook up with groups and, you know, form groups and create leadership structures that could actually, you know, make decisions to get things done. It didn't happen this time. I know the labor movement in the New York area, or at least parts of it, wanted to hook up with Occupy Wall Street. They just couldn't find a way to do it. So you knew as soon as the occupation part was over, once they got them off the street, you know, end of ball game. Mm-hmm. You know, that was it. Because with no physical presence, the issue went away.
Well, there's all kinds of other reasons. I mean, books have yet, and are probably being written now about why it flopped in a way. I don't mean metaphorically. I mean, the issue is there all over the place. But I mean, why it flopped physically. I mean, one reason is, of course, there's no draft. People's skin literally isn't in the game. That's part of the problem.
And, right, but on this issue, there was mass support for Occupy Wall Street.
That's
for
true.
The issues.
And
it was there.
And
it just required, I'm not saying it was going to turn into the anti-war movement,
mm-hmm.
but it could have been at least as solid as the Tea Party.
Right.
I mean, it could have at least been as, in terms of having a national presence. It wouldn't have taken long to hook people together. If it required an agenda, it required, you know, forming alliances, and a required organization.
Mm-hmm.
Very tough to do if you're in principle opposed to all that.
Mm-hmm.
Very tough to do. But anyway, it showed the only point I want to make is it shows the underlying resentment against Wall Street and against income inequality, because it didn't take much to change the national dialogue. And then, of course, now it's changed back again. The worst thing that can happen now is for us to be talking about these cuts. It's
mm-hmm.
ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just ridiculous, it's dangerous to do anything right now to cut back on spending. What you want to do is put more people to work, not fewer. You don't want fewer government employees. You want more government employees so that you can put more money into the economy.
Well, there's a problem with this payroll tax, you know, that they reinstituted the extra 2%. I mean, you're talking about, first of all, it's 77%. Of households, according to the Times here. 77% are affected by this. And they interviewed people making $60,000, one family making $100,000, you know, both people working. This is, people aren't going to have any savings. They aren't going to be able to spend any extra money on anything. I mean, they already, this payroll tax hike is already going to put a big dent in any kind of recovery that we have, right?
Well, it's going to put a dent. I mean, it's going to slow things down. The question is how much, and how much depends on what else they end up cutting.
Well,
I don't think they're done cutting.
Well, the next time, or it's already happening, is when they talk about this debt ceiling. Then they're going to start bringing that will be when the cuts have to come as negotiations. The question is, how much will Mr. Compromise compromise? You know.
See, the part of the story that I think even the good political analysts are missing is the Republicans can play a game of chicken, because if the economy goes south, they benefit in the next election. If the economy is going up before the next election, they lose, no matter who caused what. So if they can show, if they can they have no reason to compromise.
And it's in their political interest, even more so, for things to fail. Yeah.
Yeah. Look, first of all, it makes government look bad. That's good for them. They hate government.
Mm-hmm.
I've done some number crunching on the size of government. There's actually been a precipitous drop in public employees compared to the population in the last several years. And that's not going to work. That's going to create long-term unemployment, because the reason we have more since the 30s, government employment has gone up as a percent of the entire economy. And, of course, a lot of it's around the military as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason it's there is something has to suck up the unemployment that's caused from enormous rising productivity. In other words, we can make a whole lot more with fewer people. There's a fundamental acceleration in automation that's part of modern capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And we became aware of that from the 30s on, and government employment was always used as a way to suck up some of that unemployment and in a productive way. So we jumped up a notch then, and it stayed at a fairly consistent level, and now the public employment is dropping. And that means we're going to go back to these large surpluses of people who can't find jobs. And then, of course, what they're going to do is blame the unemployed and blame unemployment insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they'd find a job if there was a if they weren't getting unemployment insurance, or if they had better skills, et cetera, et cetera.
But I hear that all the time. In other words, if you hand things out to people, they get used to it and they'll never work.
Yeah. If you can live on unemployment insurance.
Or Social Security.
You're a
provable
person.
That's another thing that people don't even, I can't even understand. People say, Social Security, you read in the New York, I read the Times, my hometown newspaper. Social Security, it keeps people out of poverty. Oh, really? What world do you live in? $15,000 a year, $20,000 a year keeps you out of poverty? I don't think so. $25,000? That's nuts. You can hardly even buy food with that. And now they want to,
the idea of messing it with it is so uncivilized. It's sort of like so dark ages to think you're going to take something out of the pockets of senior
And yet they managed to spend all this money, and they have the politicians telling you, everywhere you look and you tune in on any kind of media, read the papers, they'll tell you, look, it's out of control, we have to do something about it, or else the debt, blah, blah, blah. There is no voice speaking up against it at all. No one, nothing. Well, so we had this conversation once before, and you were pretty clear about how you felt about it. I read in the paper today, for instance, this is just an example of almost everything we're talking about, if you take it to its logical extension, maybe economically. I read in the paper today about the collapse. Oh, a Chinese company just bought up the shares of one of the largest,
right,
if not the largest, solar panel company in this country, right? And then they go on to talk about it. It was in the business section that the solar panel industry went broke in this country because they weren't able to make enough of a profit. Now, I'm just using this as an example. Here we are frying ourselves to death on this planet using, carbon-based fuel. And obviously the way to save our planet and our lives and everybody else and to bring down the cost of fuel ultimately, in Europe they have countries where anywhere from 50 to 80% of the fuel of the electricity produced or the power comes from wind and solar and everything else. Okay, but there's not enough profit. Why can't we just go a little step further? You're talking about a financial transaction tax. We're talking about breaking up the big banks. All these kinds of things. Aren't they just one step along a path to what would ultimately be the right thing to do is just for the government to own everything that's essential? Why doesn't the government just own the electricity or the power industry or the gasoline or the oil or any of it or the banks? Why not? What's the problem?
Well,
I know it's a big complex issue. But, I mean, when you look at these things every day, and I'm just a regular person, it seems to me that's the logical extension of these arguments. Employees. and then talk about government employees. I mean, really, we'd be working and we'd be paying ourselves back because we'll be working for the government.
All right. I prefer, another way of doing it. I prefer like making massive investments in terms of weatherizing homes, putting the solar panels on homes, create a huge amount of demand by basically hiring, you know, a million people directly or indirectly to go house to house across the country and insulating and weatherizing.
So this is like in the 30s, right, that government program to do that.
Yeah, and the reason I'm not comfortable, in terms of the largest banks, I think I'd either break them up into many, many smaller banks mm-hmm. or nationalize them. I can get along with that because it's such a concentrated industry. But when you're talking about an enormously complex market system that's global, it's hard to imagine how to nationalize it and still have it function without it collapsing on itself.
Has this not happened in some South American countries? Didn't I read just the other day that some country is nationalizing the oil industry there? And hasn't it happened? You know.
Yeah, you could imagine in a smaller country that has a couple of joint projects with oil companies to take them over. They're still going to need help to get capital and technology from other people. The problem is that when larger economies have tried to do this, like they tried to do it in the Soviet Union and China, mm-hmm. as they got larger, they couldn't do it anymore. They just couldn't produce what people wanted and even needed. It was very, very hard to do it because it's hard to coordinate all that. Once you go to a planned, a nationalized economy where everything of importance is nationalized, mm-hmm. It's just hard to manage it. It becomes so there is something to having smaller competitive units that makes some sense, provided that you have a very rich, deep safety net to catch people as they're tossed off, mm-hmm. because there's going to be constant change and innovation and people are going to get laid off. You need to have programs that either subsidize them to stay where they are during deep recessions the way Germany did in the last one, or you have relocation you maintain your health care when you get laid off, you get a decent income anyway until another job is found, you get retraining. You even get sent to school and maintain your pay. There's all kinds of things you could do to make it more humane. But I'm not sure anybody's smart enough to run these enterprises if they get to be too big.
But when you talk about Medicare for all, right, single payer, you're talking about a gigantic number of enterprises, hospitals, hospital corporations,
Yeah, but you just get rid of – all you have to do is once you get rid of the insurance companies,
yeah.
half your problem's gone. Because there's a big difference in their profits and cost of administration versus Medicare's cost of administration. You just don't have to pay that extra bonus to the insurance industry.
But then,
over time, we can go back from for-profit hospitals to not-for-profit hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
That was a bad idea to encourage for-profit hospitals. Going back the other way doesn't mean you have one hospital chain that is runs all the hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
You just have a smaller a number. And the real issue isn't going to be ownership of, whether doctors in a private clinic or public clinic. The real issue is what services they're going to get paid for.
And how much.
Yeah. And that has to be determined by what's good for the health of the patient overall. And that's where the fight's going to be. They had that joke about the death panels. But in fact, the panel that determines what good health care is for a particular region, what they're going to actually pay for,
mm-hmm.
that's an important panel. And that has nothing to do with whether it's privately owned or publicly owned.
Well, right now,
it has to do with the quality of the service.
Right now, the only death panels, which have existed for quite some time and still exist, are the health insurance companies. They are the death panels. I mean,
they're just not necessary. They're just not necessary.
Well, what would you
do? They have to go.
What would you do?
I don't want to take, but see, I don't want to nationalize them. I just want to get rid of them.
Well, there's over a million people that work in that industry. What happens to them?
We're going to have to. There's this policy that a bunch of us came up with a while back called Just Transition. You have to invest some amount of money in those people and move them from those occupations to real health, if they want, real health care providing occupations, mm-hmm. like where they become nurses, nurses, assistants, nurses, et cetera, or into other fields. We're going to have to transition them out. Mm-hmm. None of this happens overnight, but it's all doable. I mean, look, we just transitioned out, a boatload full of auto workers out of Detroit. We've been doing that for years, sometimes humanely, sometimes not so humanely. We do it with defense contractors. It can be done. We do it. Right now we're doing it with nuclear weapon sites. People who used to make atomic bombs now get first crack at the jobs in cleaning up the sites.
Mm-hmm.
So many of them have been able to maintain their incomes. We can do that kind of stuff. But I'm not quite ready to go to an entirely nationalized economy.
Right. If we don't, I mean, we have a huge complex, country and gigantic economy. So maybe it won't work. It never really has worked with a gigantic, huge company in some ways. However, what has to happen, and we see that this has faltered and almost stopped and doesn't exist anymore, is if you're not going to have nationalization of all these industries, which are essential industries or other industries, what you've got to do is then, and you have small private companies and private entities and doctors or whatever else and oil companies, whatever, you're going to have people who pay attention to whether or not people are breaking the laws. In other words, watchdogs and the agencies of the federal government have completely fallen down on the job recently. So those things have to be beefed up. Talk about government employees. You need them in the Justice Department, the SEC, et cetera,
yeah.
Et cetera. Right.
Yeah. No, you need rules and regulations that make sense and that everybody has to follow for the good of all of us.
Right, the EPA.
What we have to resurrect is the notion of the common good. For the last generation, the Milton Friedman idea that if you care about profit, the rest of society will be better off, the invisible hand resurrected from Adam Smith, it's not working.
Mm-hmm.
You need to have people who actually care about the common good. When I was coming up as a kid, the idea of public service was like a really big deal.
Mm-hmm.
We felt that you should do something for the good of your fellow man, especially if you had opportunity to get an education. You should give back.
Right.
This and it was more prestigious to do public service than it was to go out and make a lot of money.
I remember those days. That's when they used to have dinosaurs pulling our carts with rock wheels. That was a long time ago, right?
Yeah. I remember Kennedy was president.
Mm-hmm.
And his brother...
What your country, et cetera.
Well, and also, I remember Robert Kennedy was saying things like, he couldn't believe that people went around just trying to make more money. It sounded to him like the most boring thing in the world to do. But it was a common thing. Of course, he had his millions already.
Right.
Dad did it. But it was a common understanding that you should serve. That working in government or working in educational systems or working in anti-poverty programs or Peace Corps, whatever, the notion was that you should serve. And of the Army, public service is frowned upon.
Well, and too bad that it's outside. Too bad that the Army is seen as public service, but that's another story. So, I mean, obviously, this is an incredibly hard question and complex to say the least. But so where do you think the country went off the tracks here? Where did this idea that it was good to help other people by serving in the public, the Peace Corps? I even worked in the welfare department in New York City. And it was not considered a hack, stupid civil service job so much. It was considered a decent thing to do, when you got out of school before you went and made your money. How did the country get so far off this track?
Wow.
That's a tough one, I know. But I mean, I'm just thinking out loud. I mean,
yeah,
that's
a heck of a question.
There's
a reason you have your job.
Well,
that's a heck of a question. I mean, what pushed it off the track? I actually think that there was a battle of ideas where the old way of doing things just ran out of steam.
Doing good for people got to be...
Well, the programs that flowed from that looked like they were such a mess. The country was in turmoil mm-hmm. at the end of the 1960s, early 1970s.
Right.
Foreign policy was a complete mess. I actually think what knocked us off the track was, we just kind of shot our wad on Vietnam mm-hmm. and maintaining the Cold War. And then you had the Arab oil boycotts and you had the, inflation hit. And it was ripe for somebody to come up and say, I've got an answer. Deregulation, tax cuts, and get rid of these labor unions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had a formula. I don't know if you've ever seen the Powell memo.
No.
Justice Powell, before he was a justice.
Oh, sure. Sure. Absolutely. Yeah.
He wrote that incredible memo that just said, hey, we got to take the country back from the kids. So they waged a concerted campaign, mm-hmm. and they pulled it off. They invested heavily in their think tanks. They invested heavily in, you know, political candidates like Reagan. And then when they got in, they did what they did, the deregulation. And it took 30 years before we paid the price. But we're really paying the price, both in terms of, you know, the crash and in terms of the environment.
Ultimately, of course, it gives birth to this horrible monster child called Citizens United. This is the, you know, so now we've completely flipped everything upside down. Corporations are people that we have to worry about their feelings. People are nobody, and we don't have to worry about them.
You know, I think the question you asked deserves a careful answer to figure out where we went off track and how to get it back on track. But I kind of, you know, we're going to need a revived labor movement. We're going to need a revived movement of hopefully student debtors. It's kind of the equivalent of the draft.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You know, instead of being sent to Vietnam, you become a chattel to the banks that basically own you because you have these huge loans on your back. That's new. That wasn't there when I was coming through.
What about the idea? What about an idea of domestic national service? In other words, when you get out of school, you can work off a student debt.
That would be good.
The government would pay off your debt if you gave them 2 years of your time building roads or cleaning up cities or whatever.
That would be good. The other thing to do would be to just have free higher education, like most of Europe has, for very very low tuitions. It's the other way to go.
And who would pay for that?
The financial transaction takes the tax on
there
Wall
you
Street.
There you go.
Wall Street brokers would go for that because this one guy I know, what he believes is you should educate everybody up through college and then they're on their own. Then no more welfare.
Mm-hmm.
But give everybody a chance, free education as far as they can go. Give it to them free. And then after that, everybody's on their own.
Mm-hmm.
He's a liberal.
A liberal broker?
Yeah, he must be, yeah.
Yeah, well,
a Jewish boy from Staten Island.
Oh, that's always possible. I mean, that split happens in New York a lot of times anyhow. So this fixed, I think people should be wary of this and fixed the debt thing. If you see these advertisements or speakers or politicians having lunch every day with people and talk about the fixed the debt people, you know, corporation executives, famous people are saying, this is how we fix the debt. Remember, this is a front group for lobbyists and corporate.
Oh, that's what the Times piece today is great on that.
Oh, it's right smack in the front page. If you want,
it's a beauty.
Everybody should read it. It's about time they got around to it. It's a little late, but it's about time they got around to it. You know,
the whole thing should have been unmasked. You know, what Peterson's doing. I mean, we should look at the tax breaks that the people pushing this already have.
Mm-hmm.
And that would tell us everything there is to know. Oh, they want to cure the government debt problem by maintaining their tax breaks and making us pay more. Oh. Yeah.
Well, they're always, you know, they're a little shrewd, like any poker player. They're willing, they'll come out in front. They'll hold up a little fake mask thing that says, yes, we need to close a few of those loopholes. And then they don't do it, or they hardly do it at all. And then the rest of it is all, we're the ones who are going to get cut, you know.
They're coming, and they're really coming after the big ones now.
Well, and, you know, also, the money is money, right? They meet every day and have lunch with the president in his office or with the head of this committee and the head of that committee.
We're meeting, right? Don't we have the same kind of influence? I mean, you're a mass media star.
Yes, and you are a famous economist. So
I'm a fraudulent economist.
Any truth to the rumor that you're being considered for Treasury Secretary?
I'd already pick somebody else. So
no.
If that rumor died.
Yeah. So who's the Treasury Secretary now? Is it Jacob
Lew?
Jacob Lew. I read somewhere, in fact, the same New York Times that we've been talking about says in another article here, he is not a Wall Street insider. Is he not?
Yet.
Yes. All right.
I want to see where Timothy Geithner ends up. That's going to be interesting.
Well, on the corporate board of this and corporate board of that.
Well, let's see where he is in 2 years. That's going to be. He's got to wait 2 years before he can really dive in.
Well, I think what you said earlier there is the way to go here, which is the essence of this show's existence, which is it's got to be outside the current political system. It's got to be on the streets. It's got to be mass demonstrations, maybe civil disobedience, because people are getting screwed, boiled in this pot like frogs, slowly but surely, and it's near the end of the boiling time. Something's got to be done.
And those of us who maybe are too old to be the key organizers,
mm-hmm.
we've got to help with focusing the agenda. Cuts in the military, financial transaction tax, single-payer health care, Medicare for all.
All right.
Those
three things.
We don't have to get complicated.
We're at the end of our hour. This is Les Leopoldin. Why don't you mention the new book that people can get?
The new book is How to Make $1 Million an Hour, Why Hedge Funds Get Away with Siphoning Off America's Wealth. Mm-hmm. And it's available, I think, right now on Kindle. And it should be out in the next month or so at your favorite bookstore.
Okay, and maybe what we can do is talk about this book later on down the road on Sirius, on Sirius XM. Okay.
Great.
All right.
Great.
Thanks
all right,
a lot.
Take care.
Okay.
Be well.
Bye. That's about it for today. Don't forget to check in with Occupied Territory Facebook page, where we'll post more of this information that we've been talking about today, and we can talk about it on there, too. Also, remember to tune in for my show on Mondays called The Turning Point, in which I talk about anything but politics, usually. So it's a relief.